Hello and welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we have a special guest with us, Aaron Stutz, the Community Conservation Manager in the Field Conservation Department at the Denver Zoo is with us. And I've been to the Denver Zoo, and that's a great experience. It's been a lot of fun when I was out there. Jesse, have you ever been to the Denver Zoo?
Yes, I was just there last year. It's a fantastic zoo.
It's a fantastic zoo, and you know, near the mountains, I love to be near the mountains. And joining me today is Jesse Lowry, our Director of Conservation and Research. How are you doing, Jesse?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to have Erin here with us today over the phone. She is one of my good friends and just has a fantastic impact on conservation and people and wildlife around the world. Welcome, Erin, to the show.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. I always spend the first couple minutes of this radio show just kind of setting the stage for our new listeners. The mission of Blank Park Zoo is to inspire an appreciation of the natural world through conservation, recreation, research, and education. And basically what I see the zoo as is a window to the wild, a place where we want to invite the community in to see all of the animals that we have here at the zoo and look into the eyes of a tiger and see the amazing agility of the sea lions and see just how tall the giraffe are and get that, that feeling of awe that we all get when we see these amazing animals. But as a AZA accredited zoo, it is our mission and our role to inspire people who come to the zoo to take these conservation actions, something that's actually going to make a difference to wildlife and wild places around the world. And so Blank Park Zoo does conservation in many different ways. We try to be as sustainable as possible, as green as possible in our daily business operations because we know that sustainability has a direct effect on wildlife, especially native wildlife. And we do a lot of local projects around here in central Iowa and regionally as well, like our pollinator conservation project, Plant Grow Fly, where we encourage people to plant butterfly gardens in their backyard or their front yard. Looking for those conservation actions, what people can do, no matter how old they are or where they live. And the real backbone of what a zoo can do to save animals in the wild, in my mind, is the support of those heroes that are out on the front lines in the range countries of the animals that we have here at the zoo and some animals that we don't have here at the zoo. We support many different projects every year, including Hornbill Research Foundation, protecting hornbills in Thailand, Giraffe Conservation Foundation, working in Namibia and other countries in Africa, Conservation Fusion, working in Madagascar to save critically endangered radiated tortoises and lemurs by uplifting the local communities. And all of the projects that Blank Park Zoo supports have some kind of education component to it and really work with the people and uplifting local communities to help, you know, save animals and help people at the same time. And that's really what we call the holistic view of conservation. And I know that Denver Zoo does that very, very well. And that's one reason why we wanted to have Erin on the show today. So Erin, let's talk a little bit. Let's just start out by telling us a little bit about your background and kind of what inspired you to be the conservationist that you are today.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for the intro, guys. This is my first podcast, so I'm pretty excited. I have been working at Denver Zoo for over 10 years, which is very exciting. Before I started here at Denver Zoo, I always had a love of nature. I think if you ask anyone that's been involved in conservation, they'll say from an early childhood they had positive experiences playing in nature, being outside. I had very encouraging parents that fostered that appreciation for being outside and respecting the wilderness. So I think that was my foundation for getting into this field. I have a background in science, so my undergraduate degree, I went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Go Badgers! which holds a special place in my heart. I love Madison, Wisconsin. And I got a degree in zoology, and I got a certificate in environmental science. So I really got to combine my love for animals with my interest in more of that approach to wilderness and environmental science. With that, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I kind of was just living for the moment in college, and I didn't really think about what was going to happen next. So I had a really inspiring mentor, and I wish I could remember his name because I give him a shout out right now. But he was one of my TAs in my environmental science classes, and he told me I should join the Peace Corps. So I thought, why not? So I joined the Peace Corps right out of college, and I got to spend almost 3 years living in the Philippines, where I was supposed to implement some type of solid waste management plan, which coming out of college, I had no idea what that meant. But what it really translated to was me getting to live in another community, understand another culture, and work together to create more sustainable practices in their community. So we did eco clubs, we started gardens, we started a health clinic. It was a really, really good and inspiring time where I realized that I loved animals and the environment, but I loved working with people and other cultures. And I thought, I wonder if there is a job where you could work with people to help them better understand the environment. And that's what I'm doing for my job right now. So there is a job out there. It's called community engagement.
I love that. And I can only imagine how your experience in the Peace Corps would just uniquely set you up for the work that you do at Denver Zoo now. And if we have time at the end of the show today, let's circle back and talk more about the Peace Corps. We might have to invite you back for another show to talk more about that experience.
Definitely.
But tell us a little bit about what it means to be the community conservation manager at Denver Zoo.
Yeah. So I actually started as an intern, which I always like to make a plug for anybody that wants to get into conservation. It can seem crazy and daunting to find your path, but it's okay to start small. And I started as an intern in a department where there was only 3 or 4 people, and now I have the position I have. So it's okay to start small, do the work. You'll get that job that you're looking for. So when I started, we were doing a lot of sound science, so a lot of ecological science in the field, which is what we base a lot of our field work on. We work in 5 field programs around the world, and we might get into that soon.
Mm-hmm.
But my role is then to kind of combine our ecological science with our social science and really get to understand these communities that we're working in. Because as we've learned, conservation will not be successful or sustainable if you don't involve people. People are everything. So really working closely with these communities where we're doing our field work and building those relationships to develop some strong conservation programs.
That sounds amazing. Please give us an example of a program where you're doing this important work of, you know, combining the ecological science and the social science.
Yeah, definitely. So one example is one of our projects is in Botswana, and we've been working there for over 10 years. We've helped create and establish a nonprofit called Kalahari Research and Conservation, and that organization is our partner, and they really kind of do on-the-ground boot work for the work that we're doing. We're looking at wild dog research and vulture research, and I've really gravitated towards the vulture work. I think a lot of people don't realize vultures are endangered, or vultures sometimes get a bad rap. So vultures are kind of my species, my spirit animal. So an example of how I do community engagement is we use the research that our team has done to understand the threats that are affecting vultures to then inform the community of what the problem is going on. So we've got all the information that vultures are declining. Here's where they're declining. These are the reasons they're declining. So then I use that ecological science to then inform the community. But it's not just a one-way conversation of, hey, this is what's happening with vultures. My job, which is challenging but fun, is to really understand what's going on in the community. Who's making up these communities? You know, is it males? Is it females? What's the age group? What's the demographic? What's going on in the community? What are some of the challenges that they're facing? Because they're never going to care about wildlife if we don't care about what's going on in their community. So I get the fun job of getting to know these people, understanding their relationship with wildlife, and then working together to come up with a solution to figure out, okay, how can we stop this vulture issue? So
that is
one example
so interesting.
Is,
yeah, I was hoping that you would kind of delve a little bit deeper too and let us know what the threats are to vultures as well.
Yeah, well, around the world, but specifically in Botswana, there's this intentional and unintentional poisoning. So unintentional poisoning is a lot of farmers don't realize that when they human-wildlife conflict is an issue. So a lot of maybe wildlife is attacking their livestock, which is their livelihood, and they need that to survive. So one way they might deal with wildlife is to, let's say, poison a carcass, hoping that that will then in turn maybe kill the wildlife that's attacking, whether it's a wild dog or a lion. What they don't know, though, is that vultures are scavengers, so they're actually eating that carcass as well. So they're unintentionally killing vultures along with a lot of other species in that area. Mm-hmm. Whereas intentional is they know that by putting poison out, they will kill those vultures. So, you know, if they're poaching illegally, what's the first thing that might give away is the vulture circling overhead. So they might intentionally be poisoning. So one job is to kind of work with the community to educate them. And a lot of times in Botswana, it's that unintentional. They just aren't aware of what their actions are doing to affect wildlife. So we've partnered with a local organization called Kalahari Conservation, and we've built a vulture restaurant. So what's a vulture restaurant? It's not a place where we go and eat vultures, but instead it's a place where we can provide lead-free, poison-free carcasses for vultures. So these vultures get to come and eat healthy food, but we also get to bring the community there and see vultures up close. And a lot of times people have never seen a vulture up close eating, and it's fascinating. And they really get to develop this love and appreciation for vultures, which is really the goal of the program. We get to inspire knowledge about vultures, inspire empathy and passion for vultures, and then they all get to leave and take an action of how they're going to, in their community, help protect vultures.
That is an incredible story, and just such a neat mental image of thinking about, you know, the carcasses out there and all the vultures coming around and the community people coming up and learning more about this amazing bird. Tell us a little bit about the ecological benefits of vultures and why we need to protect them.
Oh, there's so many. I feel like we could do a whole podcast just on vultures. They're such unique species, and they have such amazing adaptations that people don't realize how important they are to the ecosystem. We like to call them our cleanup crew. They're taking care of, especially in Botswana, we talk about how they're helping keep Botswana clean. They're getting rid of carcasses. They're helping stop the spread of diseases that could affect not only their health, but their livestock health as well. The vultures themselves just have unique adaptations. They've got great eyesight. They've got huge wingspans. They have these amazing stomachs that help them digest the meat and avoid obtaining diseases that me and you would get if we ate that meat. They have super strong beaks, and each species is just really individual. If you watch them ever attack a carcass, it's really interesting to watch. They each have kind of a different order of who gets to eat first, depending on what species they are. So vultures are awesome. That's my takeaway message from today.
Vultures are awesome. Yes. Yes. I think Ryan and I are just smiling at each other, nodding. That sounds like an incredible project. Tell us a little bit about the feedback that you've gotten from the community and what kind of impact are you seeing from this program?
Yeah, for this specific one, we started with schools. So we've really been working with the local schools in the community and helping supplement not only their environmental clubs, but a lot of teachers are excited about wildlife conservation. They just don't have the resources to educate their students about it. So we've really been partnering with them to kind of build into their curriculum lessons on vultures, along with some other wildlife, but really vulture specific, and demonstrating that you can teach about vultures in your math class, or you can teach about vultures in your English class or your history class, and working with teachers in the community to kind of get them to integrate a little bit more about wildlife conservation, specifically vultures. And then we bring the kids to the community on these field trips for a vulture camp. And the feedback has been so positive. The kids love it. They love getting, well, what kid doesn't love leaving school and going on a field trip? So that's universal. We play games. They get to see the vultures up close. They get to be detectives and do research. And the teachers really enjoy themselves, too. I think when they first find out they're going to learn about vultures, you know, everyone's reaction isn't exactly the same as getting to go see an elephant. But by the end of the day, they're all convinced that vultures are awesome. So it's been pretty good feedback from the community.
That is fantastic. Tell us a little bit about how your background and training in the science of behavior change has informed the methods that you use for this program and others.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I myself have had to continuously improve my knowledge. So when I started off, this whole concept of behavior change didn't really exist. It was a lot of environmental education of, you know, going into the schools, doing curriculum, and that was kind of our concept of community engagement. At least it was mine personally, and I've definitely evolved over the 10 years and realized there's so many tools needed to understand a community. You need to, there's psychology, there's social science, there's behavior, that you all combine to kind of understand how these communities function and how they think, because that way you can better change their behavior. So I think my experience from undergrad, the basic foundations of science helped. I think living abroad helped me understand how to navigate working in another country. And then through my job, I've really just taken the opportunity to educate myself, taking classes. There's so many amazing resources and trainings out there specifically on behavior change that have helped me kind of navigate this new field that I'm exploring in community engagement.
What is one thing that has surprised you the most about working in this field?
How I think I knew this, but it still surprises me every day of how long it takes to see change occur. I think with the conservation work and environmental work, the results are long-term. So it's always surprises me. I've been doing this for 10 years, and we're slowly now just starting to see some change on the ground in terms of helping wildlife populations. And I always am surprised at when I look back how long some of this work can take.
Because people are really entrenched in their traditions and their behaviors, and not just talking about, you know, the good folks in Botswana, but all over the world, every single one of us, we are creatures of habit. And so that's why I think that behavior change is so interesting as well, because really you can just advertise the benefits of vultures and you can really just find out what are the solutions to all of these challenges of human-wildlife conflict and losing livestock to predators and things like that, and bringing those all together to make a bigger benefit for the community. And it sounds like you're doing some really, really fantastic work. Can you give us an insight on another program, another area that you're working besides Botswana?
Yeah, definitely. Let's see. I'm trying to see how many more I get to talk about, so I don't want to, not that I have favorites, but I kind of have favorites. So another one that has a different angle than working with the schools and teachers is our project in Peru. So we've been working in Peru specifically with a frog called the Lake Titicaca frog. Yes, I just said Titicaca on a podcast. So this frog is endemic to Lake Titicaca, and they're declining due to pollution, but also because of human consumption. People are actually taking them out of the lake, selling them to people in Lima or other major cities in Peru, and drinking them and consuming them in frog milkshakes.
Wow.
Yeah, which has been a really interesting project because, you know, it's a unique cultural approach to a project. So we've been working with the community to better understand their motives for wanting to do this. And one motive, obviously, we discovered was an economic motive. Obviously, they're selling the frogs because they need money. So one thing that we did was work with some of the women in the community and said, hey, maybe instead of harvesting the frogs, we could create a collective where you make handicrafts and you also can sell the handicrafts to make money, but instead of selling the frog, you can sell your handicrafts. So this has been a really fun project we've been working on for about 7 years, and the collective has almost 36 women now in Peru, and they make these adorable frog knitted handicrafts from hats to scarves to puppets that they they sell to tourists, and they also sell here in our gift shop as well.
That's incredible. And we can see through many different projects that folks around the world are just looking for a way to make a sustainable livelihood for their families. And so when we can go in and help train folks on different ways to make that livelihood, it can solve some of those problems for their families and then in turn for wildlife.
Correct.
So have you been able to travel to Peru as well as Botswana?
I have, yes.
Wonderful.
I think it's important. It's also a challenge in the job is working when you do international work, working remotely. So I think it's so important to be able to go and connect with these communities and have as much face time as possible.
I think our listeners would be interested in just hearing, you know, one of your favorite stories from the field of something that you didn't expect to happen or some trials and tribulations that you had traveling to these far off places. What comes to mind?
There's so many stories. I mean, I'm even thinking of Peace Corps stories.
Yeah, that would be fine.
For some reason, they always end up having to do with unplanned events. And I think a lot of these trips are, you have somewhat of an outline of a plan, but you just go in completely open-minded and being able to be adaptable, because whatever you thought was going to happen completely shifts and the opposite happens. So I think a lot of my fun stories have come from just being open to the unknown, car breaking down, being stranded for 3 days, meeting people that you never thought you'd meet, having meetings get canceled, and then in return, you get to go see elephants instead. So I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head. I think a Peace Corps story that always makes me laugh is we got lost on a hike. We were trying to find a community, and we took a wrong turn. We ended up being lost for, like, 2 days, and we were crossing some pretty sketchy rivers. And long story short, I had an open wound on my foot that I wasn't aware of, and it turned into worms, which turned into appendicitis, and I had to get my appendix removed. So I think there's sometimes always funny, not so funny, but very odd health issues that happen as well when you're traveling remotely to some of these places.
It just shows everyone how dedicated you are to this field.
Yeah, I'm hardcore. Got my appendix removed. Come on.
So tell us what, in your mind, is important for people to know, people in the U.S. That are just going about their daily lives. What can people do to help save wildlife?
That's a great question. And we get that a lot, too, because not only am I doing work in the field, but I also work here at Denver Zoo. So we have a lot of opportunity to connect with the public here. You know, there's always things that we like to tell the public. But personally, what I like to say is I think it's so important to just get inspired. And whatever that looks like, find out what you love, find out what you're good at, and just get involved, whatever that looks like. And I think a lot of people get overwhelmed because they see climate change and everything is big and scary and how am I going to address that? But I think the best thing is to find something that you love, get inspired, whether it's a bird, a ladybug, a polar bear, and just start taking action. And something small, you could do something so small as plant a pollinator garden in your backyard, recycle, get involved in a local chapter in your community that's helping polar bears internationally. Recycle. These are all little things that slowly start to change your behavior, but they really do make a difference. I think the more that you're inspired and you're starting to take action, you build this momentum, and something that might start off small can slowly grow into something bigger. And right now, we just need people to take action. And do something, and don't be overwhelmed by how big the situation is, but do something small, be kind to each other, and just remember that, yeah, we're all connected.
Yeah, I love that. And, you know, it provides a little bit of a segue to our work together, Erin, with the Finding Your Voice summits.
Yeah.
We've got about 3 minutes left. So tell us a little bit about your experience with Finding Your Voice, and then we'll end the show with how we find out more about your work at Denver Zoo.
Yeah, definitely. So Finding Your Voice is this amazing new movement to get people involved in wildlife conservation. My role and connection to this project is that I think it's such an important movement is to show people the different ways that you can get involved in wildlife conservation, whether it's a career or just a passion project. I've recently started a program here at Denver Zoo that looks to get more women involved in wildlife conservation because at times they're an underserved population in a lot of these communities we're working. So finding your voice is really this chance to hear from women or professionals that are currently doing wildlife conservation and sharing their story of how they got to where they are, their life story, things that they did, internships they took, mentors they had, with the hope that others can learn and hear these stories and become inspired and say, you know what, I can have a career or I can do something in wildlife conservation. I have a voice, I have something to offer, and I also want to make a change in the world.
And it's been such a fun experience to present at Finding Your Voice with you. The first one was in Columbus, Ohio at Otterbein University in 2016. And then you hosted one at Denver last year. And mm-hmm. we just had another one in Columbus at Otterbein University. I think that we'll probably plan a Finding Your Voice summit here in Iowa or Nebraska here in the next Woo-hoo! Year or so. And I think I would agree with everything you said, that it's just about mentoring and, you know, really empowering young people to blaze a path to wildlife conservation and, you know, figuring out how you can make a living saving animals maybe isn't the easiest thing in the world. And so if we can all help each other, lift each other up, network, and provide any guidance and tips, I think that the ripple effects of those conversations and those, you know, mentoring conversations can be felt for a really long time. So I'm just really excited to have you on the show today, Erin. Thank you so much for all the work that you do to save wildlife and wild places around the world. We're definitely going to invite you back to talk more about your different programs. In the meantime, how do people find out more about what you do at Denver?
Yeah, I think the best way is to just check out our website, denverzoo.org, and click on the field conservation page, and there will be a lot more information about our 5 field programs. We have some fun fact sheets where you can learn not only where we work, but how we're doing conservation in these communities.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Erin.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
And thank you for joining us today. And if you want to learn more about Blank Park Zoo, head over to our website at blankparkzoo.com. Well, we're out of time, so we'll see you next time on Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.